Okay.
Welcome to the Permaculture Pimp Cast with your host, the Permaculture Pimp Daddy and the Pasture Raised Pimp. Get your recommended daily allowance of permaculture, preparedness, and practical living. Tip a pimp. Stay alert, stay alive. Permaculture is my passion. Oh yeah, welcome to the bonus episode of the Permaculture Pimp Cast, where PIMP stands for Permaculture is my passion. As always, this episode brought to you by twooldcrowshomestead.com. Turn that simp into a pimp. Get some of that ball and soap that they got over there. You know what? They've been a sponsor from day one on this Pimp Cast. Heaven's Harvest, y'all, 10% off with promo code PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. Remember, handle all your preparedness needs at the crib if you have to, and then later on, if you need more, you know where to go. Heaven's Harvest. If you like, don't forget, you can always tip a pimp over on the Fountain app. Listen to all your podcasts over there, starting with the Pimp Cast, of course. And remember, if you'd like to drop some of those derivations of a Bitcoin called Satoshis, which I can never pronounce right, or sats, if you'd like to drop some SATs on some PIMPs, you know where to do it. Do it over there on the Fountain app. You can listen to all your podcasts over there. Triple up the speed if you have to. EMP Shield, y'all, $50 off with promo code PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. And don't forget Harvest, right? So we got a link for all that down below, but we're going to have a link for a lot of other things down there. All right, y'all, I'm not even going to play around because my next guest is somebody I've been wanting to talk to forever and a day. And all my friends and family back in Oklahoma, particularly Oklahoma City, you're going to want to pay special attention because I got somebody on with me today that, frankly, it's been forever and a day. I told him before we went live, back when I was doing radio, I wanted to interview him way back when he first came out with one of his documentaries, which we'll talk about here in a minute. And the people at the station were never going to allow this to happen, especially when you check out the work that he's produced and the things that he's brought to light. Folks, it is I can't even begin to tell you. I never really thought in my life I'd ever get the opportunity to talk to him, but here he is, present and accounted for, Chris Emery. How you doing?
Oh, thank you. And that's quite an honor and a great intro, and I appreciate it. It's you know, we've been doing interviews, good Lord, even before the film was released, probably for the last 15 years. I never, ever take an interview for granted. So it's an honor to be on your show, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's a real joy to have you here. For the folks that don't know, we're getting new people all the time. Look, y'all, I was raised in Oklahoma, particularly South Oklahoma City. Graduated high school there. When I went off to the Army, it was in Oklahoma City. Came back from the Army, went to Oklahoma City. That's where it all began for me. And got a lot of family and friends still back there. And a lot of them are listening to this podcast right now, and they are going to be floored because, sadly, a lot of folks in Oklahoma don't know anything about the information that Chris has presented in his documentary called A Noble Lie. Now, he has others as well. Hopefully, we'll cover those as well. Chris, why don't you give us, you know, every good superhero has a good origin story. Why don't you give people out there a little bit of background on yourself? Yeah, let's start there.
Well, you know, I started out as a photographer in high school with the yearbook staff. And then I came up with the idea to become a freelance photographer with Big Ten football. There was a niche that needed to be filled just to concentrate on the players, the coaches, the wives, the girlfriends of the players, and the band members and the cheerleaders. So I was very, very blessed and very fortunate to be able to not only do well, but actually make a pretty good living doing that for 8.5 years. Came time to decide if I wanted to go from the old school SLR, the silver oxide film, to digital. And that was a time for me to make the jump from working behind the camera to in front of the camera. During that 8.5 years, I had a great honor of meeting a lot of my media colleagues in radio, television, and film, and their work intrigued me. And I got to know what they did literally on a weekly basis for at least 5.5, 6 months out of the year as we were on the road or at home shooting football. And I had the opportunity to work in front of the camera doing bit parts in commercials, doing some fashion print work. But what really My wheelhouse is being a project manager. I like to take the, as they say, the 5,000-foot view and bring the team together. I'm really good at that. So got an opportunity to work for a small production studio in Fort Worth. We did biographical documentaries, training videos, commercials, and pretty much everything in between. Most of the projects were probably maximum about 35 minutes. But what I learned during that time, and I had a great boss, great owner of the small studio, was that he taught me on budget, learning how to get the client lined up, and the talent, dealing with all of the union issues, if we had union talent come in from LA. So that was the building block to understand how to put a documentary film together. So I want to say up to that point, it was probably about 14 years I was in the industry. And then I had the opportunity to work on the accidental U.S. military shootdown of TWA Flight 800. That was not a center fuel tank explosion. And it's wild, the synchronicity that came together on the Oklahoma City connections that helped me research that project. Little did I know, after I was asked to step away from that, threatened by the employees union at TWA, of all things, International Association of Machinists, based at Lambert Field in St. Louis, who oddly enough were major donors to the Clinton reelection campaign. So the politics, again, came full circle on that. But anyway, a friend of mine in Fort Worth had a good friend that was with the PBS affiliate in Oklahoma City, as well as I believe it was Channel 9 out of Tulsa. And they were shooting raw footage the morning of the bombing. And for a lot of folks that aren't aware, that morning of the bombing, there was actually a prayer breakfast. Bear with me here for one second. I apologize. I'm going to get this screen back up. There we go. There was actually a prayer breakfast going on at the convention center about six blocks south of the bomb site. They had the mayor, the governor, all of the aldermen, the rabbis, the pastors, and the Catholic priests. And that was at, I believe, convened at 8 o'clock that morning. The bombing happens at 9 o'clock, and it just so happened that a lot of the press were away from the studios. They were basically had their morning, AM team down there covering the event. And lo and behold, everything just broke loose at about a few minutes after 9 o'clock. So they raced up to the crime scene. They were rolling footage on what was then what they called the Betamasters. This was on the cusp of all the stations going to digital, but they still had the 3/4-inch wide beta heavy duty, high resolution SVHS masters, Betamasters. And what we were to get from my friend in Oklahoma City or in Fort Worth was about almost 3.5 to 4 hours of footage that was shot that morning that wasn't vetted by CNN or CBS or ABC or the NBC flagship stations out of Chicago, New York, and Atlanta. And they said, oh, no, we can't run this up the satellite uplink. This is too graphic. And what I saw in that film was just absolutely astounding. About 30 minutes into seeing the footage, and again, this was shot by the PBS affiliate and some of the other affiliates and Channel 9 out of Tulsa, was that the official narrative not only didn't make any sense, there was basically no proof to believe the official narrative other than the fact that 168 people, including 3 unborn children, were brutally murdered. Anyway, so after I finished watching that footage of my buddy, he says, look, I know you really got sacked on the TWA case. Would you be interested in making a film about Oklahoma City? And it took me almost about 9 months to decide to move forward. I was still in the thick of a lot of projects with the small studio in Fort Worth. I tendered my resignation and I decided to make the move to Oklahoma City, which should have been about a year later after doing a 1-year hiatus in New Mexico, just to kind of clear my head. I was living outside of Albuquerque, put the outline together, and then I made the official move in the third day of January of 2003. And as they say, the rest is history. Now, I do want to continue on here real quick. If it wasn't for the local, county, state, and federal law enforcement, there's no way that we would have got this film out. There were 75 volunteers, both in law enforcement and outside, including the core group of about 15, which would end up, most of those 15 would end up being the film crew. So it wasn't just me. I was a very important integral part, but I do have to share the credit where credit is due. And so that was basically the start of our first film on the Oklahoma City bombing.
Now that film was called A Noble Lie. And
Correct. And here again, serendipity and synchronicity come together. The film is called A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. and it's available on our website, Freemind Films, with an S, freemindfilms.com. It wouldn't be until our second film that Richard Grove, who helped us co-produce our second film, State of Mind, Psychology of Control, he actually released a film about a year and a half before our first film came out called The Noble Lie. So the irony and the coincidence is just unbelievable. But a lot of people get us confused with that film, but just wanted to kind of clear that right there.
Well, I find the title curious. I mean, because it brings me right back to Plato and, yes. You know, I mean, the parallels, it's been a long, long time since I've watched your film, but I remember just being absolutely smacked in the face when all this information that I thought I knew was absolutely made. When I saw that, I'm thinking, you have got to be kidding me. I can't believe how much of this stuff never saw the light of day. I can't believe all this went on. Then I learned about Terence Yakey, and then I learned about, and then I read Stephen Jones's book, Others Unknown.
Yes, sir.
And I'm like, and then it led me down this path where I'm even looking into that. I believe it was a Channel 4 reporter who was really doing some really hard hitting investigative work. And then all of a sudden she gets sent on the first thing smoking out of OKC.
It was Jana Davis. Yes, sir. The New York Jana Times Davis. Bought out Channel 4. They bought out Channel 4. What we found out that she wasn't actually fired. They just didn't renew her contract. And when it came up for renewal, they chose to not keep her, quote unquote, on the staff, including the news director, Melinda Klinzing, who knew, and I'd say three quarters of the staff at Channel 4, including the other affiliates, including your PBS, some of our contacts at PBS in Oklahoma City, knew that there were a lot more questions and a lot more people involved with this case than we were being told. And they were threatened with their jobs. Of course, Jana's contract was never renewed. So it was both overt and covert pressure on the news media to keep this thing really tempered down.
Chris, I want to get back to the origin of this a little bit more, but I want to tell you where I was and what I was doing when this thing went off. At the time I was stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado. And it's one of those things where you knew exactly what you were doing, where you were in the whole nine yards. Guy walks in and says, hey, you know, of course, phones and stuff were not even thought of, cell phones and things like that at the time. Sure. And guy walks in and says, hey, man, aren't you from Oklahoma? I'm like, yeah. Hey, man, there was a bombing that just went on. And then, of course, I'm looking at the Murrah building. Like I said, I grew up there. I know where this building is. I know the whole nine yards. Now, I want to give you a little bit of background. I can't go through all of it, but in a nutshell, it was my job in the military as one of those people that knew how to take down buildings. It was my job to know how to do that. And I can honestly tell you it didn't happen right off the bat, but in time, when they said it was I'll put it this way. Here's why I knew there was a rat. Because ANFO, or ammonium nitrate free-flowing compound, cannot do what I saw. We used it in the military for cratering charges. That's right. What we use it for. It has a low detonating velocity, has more of a pushing effect. So we used it in basically making craters in the ground so vehicles can't drive through it. Right. Used a lot. Used an awful lot. And it's, you know, even if you buy this stuff off the shelf. Okay, so when that went off, and then they said it was an ANFO bomb, all of us that knew anything about explosives were like, hold on a minute. Got news for you. You're not stripping reinforced concrete with no ANFO. It ain't happening that way. It ain't gonna go down that way. So right off the bat, I smelled a rat. In fact, I was calling in to local talk stations in Colorado Springs where I was stationed. And being the person that was from there, I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. This is not, I don't care what happened. I wasn't smelling a rat in terms of the deeper meaning to everything that was going on. But I knew for a fact, based on my background as a U.S. Army sapper, that the official story was an absolute lie because ANFO can't do that. Correct. So, I mean, let me bring you back a little bit, Chris. So when this thing went off, was there of all the projects, you had a good living, you were doing all this stuff. You had a good life going. You had to know that by doing something like this, it was going to cost you a great deal. Did it?
It did. In fact, you know, not to get too personal, but my ex and I were going through a separation, and she thought I had completely lost my mind. Obviously, we were married at that point for almost 6.5 years. She knew I wasn't crazy, but she said, what the hell are you thinking here? You're taking this project on. And I said, look, you know, again, my background, before I got into to film and doing the photography with the football team, I was actually an undergrad student, for 2 years as a civil engineer. So again, similar to you, I knew how to take down long span bridges and control demolition on commercial buildings. So when I saw this, I says, all right, obviously this narrative doesn't make any sense. Let's clear the table and put together something that does make sense based on, again, local, county, state, federal law enforcement, the after action reports, the white paper that was written by the Oklahoma City Police Department. Then we were very blessed to get an expert, General Penton Barton. He was a one-star brigadier general. We interviewed him in the film, and I actually sat down at his dining room table. It was in the fall of 2003, and it was like sitting across the table from Einstein. And I'm not being, you know, exaggerating here, but he wrote down both sides of 7 pages of legal pad of formulas and stuff that I understood about maybe half of what he was talking about with my background. But, you know, he laid it all out. And his job as the head of the Pentagon Armament Lab for 18 years, he was spending billions of dollars of military budget to blow up small cities out in the middle of the White Sands Missile Range in southern, south central New Mexico. So it was his job to basically take out buildings as big, if not bigger, 3-4 times the size of the Murrah building. And he was absolutely adamant about the fact that, no, we weren't being told the truth. And so I was very honored, and we were very honored as a film crew to get him on as an expert, consultant. Let's see, there was the head of who invented the neutron bomb. He was also adamant about that. And in fact, he did a hat tip to General Parton that we wanted to get the, bear with me here. I forgot the name of this, the doctor who invented the neutron bomb. His name's slipping me right now.
Yeah, me too. Right?
You know, I think you know what I mean. Anyway, he said, no, get General Parton on. He says, he was kind of camera shy. He says, I really think you need to interview General Parton. And, it was even the Russian counterpart to General Parton, who these guys had the utmost respect for him. They were going through the nuclear disarmament treaty with Russia and the U.S. military. And they said, oh, no, General Parton's the expert's expert. So, but to answer your question, yeah, that's there were so many. As they say, the arrows are pointing in the direction of not only did the narrative didn't make any sense, but there were 30 to 40 different reasons why. And we tried to chapterize that and lay that out in the film. And even then, Billy, we had 6.5 hours of footage shot and we had to narrow it down to 2 hours. So there was even more in some, the information in the film was good, but we even had more that we could have put in. We just didn't have the time for him to do it, and so that's where we were.
Well, will there be a part two to this with some of the additional footage that you have there?
There will be. We want to do a follow-up. My goal is to do a follow-up on the 25th anniversary, 30th anniversary now. 25th, just, I guess, what the 25th will be coming up, what? No, we did pass 28. We want to do 30. Time flies. So the 30th will be in 2025, and that's what we want to try to do, a follow-up to basically where are they now, and interview some of the folks that we had in the film and bring out more relevant evidence. So again, I don't want to hit your audience with a fire hose. We're trying to encapsulate 8.5 years of work that we did before the film was released, and there's still more information coming out that we get from first responders and search and rescue, search and recovery personnel that still are seeing the film and contact me on a monthly basis.
So these guys, they're still hitting you up now, even after this time.
Yes, sir.
Well, some of those people, as I understand it, were threatened, particularly the officer that had the K-9 unit. I mean, we had a bunch of mysterious deaths all throughout, this whole thing. You want to speak to any of that?
Don Browning was threatened by, I believe, a female FBI officer that met him in the hallway of the Oklahoma City Police Department early on. I believe it was within 2 months after the bombing, but well before the first federal trial. And then there was Sergeant Terrence Yakey. And I got to say this, before we even went into pre-production, I moved to Oklahoma City in January of 2003. And I got to meet Terry's mom, his two sisters, former brother-in-law, the 92-year-old, well, she was 83 at the time, 83-year-old grandmother, and a couple of the aunts. And I remember sitting down in the living room, a small town about 40 miles northeast of Oklahoma City. And I told all of them, I said, I'd been studying Terry's case for about a year and a half before I even moved to Oklahoma City. And I says, we're going to put at least 8 to 12 minutes about Terry's story in one of the chapterized sections of the movie. And by gosh, we came in at, I believe, the total runtime was 8 minutes and 12 seconds on that segment. But Terry Ickey was a 7.5 year veteran of the Oklahoma City Police Department. And he was a first responder. He was actually issuing a traffic ticket, I believe about 6 blocks away from the Murrah building at the time of the blast, multiple blasts. And he dropped his ticket book and hopped in his black and white squad car and raced toward the scene, knowing that I found out later that he had some severe back problems. He was going through therapy. I got to meet the son of the chiropractor that he was seeing, and he was due to have some reconstructive minor back surgery because of his injuries. And son of a gun, if his adrenaline didn't kick in that first 2-3 hours after the bombing, and he pulled out 8 people, one gentleman that was bigger than, heavier than him. Terry stood at about 6'5 and weighed almost 290 pounds, big guy. He was recruited, and scouts from the NFL as well as the NBA were looking at him out of high school. That's how talented and you know, athletically minded he was. But anyway, what Terry saw when he, you know, he was kind of going around the crime scene before they cordoned it all off, and he knew there was unexploded ordnance. There were devices in the building. And this is a veteran police officer that, you know, when you arrive in a crime scene, whether it be a murder scene or drug, you know, interdiction, he was with the DARE program and worked vice squad. He knew how to take mental notes immediately. And so that whole interior notebook in his brain was running, you know, in a full tilt. And he turned out a 13.5-page report. His commanding officer, Lieutenant Joanne Randall, and even the chaplain of the police department told him to cut down that report to a page and a half. And he told him, I'm not lying for anybody. And for the next year and 3 weeks, he was threatened. And he was found brutally murdered in a farm field outside of El Reno, Oklahoma. It's about 32 miles due west of Oklahoma City on I-40. And he was found in a farm field about a mile from the front gate of the El Reno Federal Penitentiary, and shot in the back of the head, execution style, hogtied, and had ligature marks on his wrists, and his neck was slit. Excuse me, I'm not going to get graphic here, but I did get to see the, it wasn't an autopsy, it was a medical examiner's report, 2 photos when they brought him in on the gurney, and there was no autopsy performed. And our film crew helped the family, the mom and the grandmother and the sisters. Oh gosh, we went through the county court and the attorney general's office and finally the medical examiner's office. And I got to tell you, that staff of the medical examiner's office opened up all the doors. They rolled out the red carpet for us. And they said, we've been waiting for you to help this family out. We want you to know what happened. And we saw the extended file, not the 1 or 2 pages they were giving to the press. You get an occasional interest in from the New York Times or maybe People magazine. They were giving them the cursory two-page report. Now, this was an extensive file that was on Terry. And I'll never forget sitting in the living room with his mom, who since passed on. Her name was Lou. And I said, Lou, are you ready for these photos? I said, this is pretty graphic. And she put her arm around my wrist. She says, sweetheart, she says, I saw Terry's body at the funeral home. And I, stupid me, I just, you know, I thought, oh gosh, wouldn't I put my foot in my mouth? But she says, it's okay. I says, she had to identify Terry's body. I can't even imagine what that family went through. And, you know, it's unbelievable. Terry was murdered, and that's still an unsolved homicide case. He did not commit suicide. And we know that for a fact.
Now, regarding him, I'm going to ask you to kind of, you know, put on your, I'm going to ask you to guess a little bit here. Over the years, I've heard people talk about what Terry might or might not have known or what he might have had in his possession. Sure. Do you have any opinion on any of that? Some people said that he had evidence that maybe would have thrown a monkey wrench in what they were, the official story that came out regarding all this.
Yes, sir. There were a couple of very good police officers. And once again, like I said, if it wasn't for the good officers that actually went through the academy with Terry, one of them at Terry's funeral had a van packed and moved away. And he ended up getting a job with the Arlington, Texas Police Department, which is between Fort Worth and Dallas. He was so disgusted at how he knew what Terry had accumulated. And it was stored in a a bank safety deposit box at a bank, and it was just north of El Reno. So that was the evidence that he was going to present if, in fact, the grand jury was impaneled, that he could bring it to. And so he was murdered on May 8th, 1996. And it was that day that he went out to that afternoon that he went out to the bank to get that information. He knew, again, being on vice squad and an experienced police officer, that he was being tailed by what he told a friend on the police force, calling him from his flip phone at the time, that he was being tailed. And that was the last conversation anybody had with him. We estimate that was between 1:30 and 2 o'clock, excuse me, 1 and 1:30 that afternoon. His car was found at about 5:30 by a reserve sheriff's deputy from the county just west of Oklahoma County, which would include El Reno. And then at about 8:30 that evening, his mother was given the call, and they said they found Terry's body leaning up against a tree with, you know, alleged suicide. But again, all of the arrows were not pointing in the direction of a suicide. He was brutally murdered. What we found out, and I'm going to go, I don't want to get long-winded here, about a year into our investigation of the Oklahoma City case, and there were so many people that helped us on this, including William W. Craig Roberts out of Tulsa, a former investigator with the Tulsa Police Department. He got a 1/2-page handwritten memo from a source that he had at the U.S. Prosecutor's Office in downtown Oklahoma City. And I was able to transcribe that from handwritten, and I typed it out and sent it back, emailed it back to Craig, and I says, would you verify what's on this? And this source said that Terry was murdered by basically a service that the CIA would hire to do their dirty work. If you can imagine, when the CIA doesn't want to get involved, they don't want to get their hands dirty. And these were folks that the CIA basically had to keep on a short leash. And they said, yeah, they came in, did the dirty work, got it done, and they left. And as Craig says, those are the folks that come in, whether it be male or female, they could be a disguise as a cleric or whatever. And they just walk between the raindrops. You will never see them again. So that's who we suspected killed Terry and left. What's even more disturbing is that Sam Gonzalez, who was the police chief at the time, and I don't have any problem dropping these people's names. They to this day, they have to be held accountable for what they did to that family, Terry's family, and how they continue to lie and obfuscate and just completely disrespect on so many levels the family of Terry and the citizens of Oklahoma City. Sam Gonzalez, William Berry, Bill City, and he was a predecessor to the current police chief. Rick, let's see here. He was the FBI special agent in charge of the Oklahoma City case. Bob Ricks, excuse me. And then there were several other higher up in command that chose to lie about what happened to Terry. What we found out from some of the reserve deputies that were absolutely disgusted how the Oklahoma City Police Department handled the crime scene in their jurisdiction in this county. It's not Cleveland County. I believe it's, I forgot the county, just west of Oklahoma County. But for them to come in, take Terry's body off the crime scene, and then have a crew, they didn't even know who these guys were, at least seven of them, with spade shovels to completely turn over the crime scene, corrupting any forensic evidence. If there was any ballistics, it was gone. Bob Ricks was there. Sam Gonzalez was there. They knew that these two individuals flew into the helicopter. Even the helicopter pilot witnesses, and he was astounded. Because he's flown into different crime scenes, and he says, you do not, under any circumstance, corrupt the crime scene like that. They had no problem, no qualms doing that for Terry. And there was no autopsy performed because the truth would have come out that it wasn't a suicide and it was a unsolved homicide case.
Man. So. Well, I would love to hear, well, I mean, I just don't
I
even
hope know. I'm not going into tangents here. I don't mean to go off.
No, I absolutely hope you do, because a majority of the people out there have never, ever heard any of this information. And certainly most of it, that's not even in your, I mean, I'm sure there's a number of things that are not in your documentary, but folks, if you haven't seen the documentary, you got to see this, because it was a precursor in so many different ways to 9/11. In fact, there's even a little bit of overlay with Oklahoma City in 9/11. Sir. I'm not sure if you want to get into that, because as I recall, there was a grand jury put together, and believe it or not, I kind of have, I met Hoppy Heidelberg a couple of times. He was one of the grand jurors there. And I remember I was fresh out of the Army. And I told him what I thought. And it was basically at a, it was a town, like a town hall type thing, but it was also being covered by AM 1000 KTOK back in Oklahoma City.
Sure.
And anytime anybody would even come close to talking about the real events that happened in Oklahoma City, you know, they were passing the mic on. They would never, it was like, I know it sounds crazy to a lot of people, but I even suspect that they must have been in on it, or at least told, don't let anybody talk about this sort of thing. Well, yes. Hoppy wasn't having it. I was there. I was there, and I'm not sure if you knew Hoppy. I didn't know him well, but
Hoppy was amazing.
There wasn't any letting it go.
No.
So, and
he was. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is that now Hoppy's since passed away. Mm-hmm. But he was on that grand jury, and he was really one of the ones that blew the whistle about. You know, he actually being a Mensa kind of person, I mean, he was a pretty sharp dude, and he knew what he could and could not do as a grand juror.
Correct.
Did this grand jury ever really come to anything worthwhile? It sure does seem funny that the contents of what they found out was made known. If correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't it happen on 9/11?
Well, actually, let me rewind the tape, as they say. Hoppy was that grand jury, I believe, was impaneled in January of 95. And they had a 10-month term, so it was going to basically disband, and they get a fresh group in October, while the bombing happens in April. Hoppy was one of the 12 grand jurors. He actually let us borrow his official grand jury handbook. We scanned it, and it's in the film as part of the graphics, the motion graphics that we had. And Hoppy was an absolutely amazing consultant. We had Charles Key, a former state rep, General Parton, Don Browning, Craig Roberts. And Hoppy was there to give us the perspective on the grand jury. Now, he wasn't the foreman. He was just one of the 12 members. But he was the only one that was really asking relevant questions, to the point where he put together it was a 2.5-page letter. He addressed it to David Russell, who was the presiding judge at the time, officiating over the grand jury. And David Russell, there were three choices that he had to make a decision on Hoppy's request. To grant the request, there were 22, including expert witnesses, ballistic experts, some of the retired and active architects from the firm that designed the building. He wanted forensic evidence brought before the grand jury, and they were actually impaneled at Tinker Air Force Base because the federal courthouse just across the street and south of where the mirror building stood, the judges' chambers and a lot of the buildings, the rooms and windows were completely demolished. They were going through serious remodeling for about 3 months. They couldn't impanel the grand jury there, so they were at the air base. Hoppy, in October of that year, right before the grand jury was going to be disbanded, in fact, the letter was dated, I believe, that first week, October 8th. And the judge could have granted the request, said no for reasons, or basically dismissed him with no reason at all. And he chose option number three, threatened him with contempt and jail time if he asked any questions or revealed any of the details of what they went through. Hoppy was furious. He says, no. That's not the way I was raised. That's not the oath I took when I became a jury member. And he was, in fact, Jana Davis drove out to his house. And she basically blew that story open. That did not sit well with the FBI field office nor the prosecutor's office. And, I want to share something with you. In February of 2003, I had the opportunity to sit in Hoppy's kitchen. We shared a pot of coffee. And for about 2 hours, he walked me through on what had happened. It got to the point where he refused to keep his mouth shut. And that's just the way he was. He wasn't being a jackass. He wasn't swearing. He wasn't, grandstanding. He just wanted to get the questions answered. And there were a lot of them out there. And he said he was visited by an attorney. And his wife did vouch for this after Hoppy had passed away. I had a conversation with her. And she says, oh, yeah, that's basically the fork in the road. There was an attorney that was hired by what we found out was a service, how do we say this, tactfully. Basically, they ran in the same circles as the group that killed Terry Yakey. That's all I'm going to say. And this was a third-party service at the CIA and the Justice Department and the prosecutor's office. We know, going all the way up to the steps of the White House. We have no qualm saying that. That's how heavy and that's how dark this work was. that they said, look, Hoppy, we know where your wife works. We know where your grandkids are going to school. We know where your kids live. And they were all over the country at the time. And they said, you need to back off or this is what's going to happen. And he pretty much laid out the laundry list. Well, it didn't take, you know, Hoppy being a Mensa member, it didn't take long for him to put two and two together. And that's when he said, Chris, he says, he wasn't a drinker, but he hit the wine bottle for about 3 months after that. And he says, I mean, he went down a slippery slope. Luckily, he was able to get himself back together. And his neighbors didn't want him to call him anymore. They didn't want his number on their phone bill. And they didn't want to talk to him anymore because they were threatened. So here you have a multi-million dollar horse breeder that was asked to serve on a grand jury, asked relevant questions, and really dig down deep to find out what happened. To a guy driving, he just almost went bankrupt, driving a school bus and hauling fuel oil during the wee hours in the morning just to make ends meet. That's how they tore his life apart. And they threatened his life. And wow. He said when he saw that gentleman drive up to his little roundabout in front of his house, and he saw him through the bay windows, he knew damn well who this guy was coming to behalf. Hoppy wasn't stupid.
So, no, anyway,
go ahead.
Well, he went on to say, I don't know that he ever said this publicly, but he said there were literally, and I know what people think when they hear this sort of thing, but there were literally helicopters flying over his house, black helicopters, yes, unmarked black helicopters. Did he ever tell you about that?
Oh yeah. In fact, he said that he'd walk out. He'd they'd be sitting down for dinner with his wife and whoever company they had over the house. He'd hear the rotors of the helicopter, and they would land in a field, you know, a good 200-300 yards within eyesight out of the bay window. They knew damn well where he could see at that time of day for dinner. He'd get out there and wave them on, said, "Hey, I know you're here." And his big fear was that they drop a bladder of gas on his house and shoot a flare and set it on fire. And they could have done that at 2-3 o'clock in the morning when they were sound asleep. So Hoppy wasn't naive. He wasn't cavalier, but he dug in like a Georgia Tech and he wasn't going to quit. And, you know, I remember going to his funeral and talking to his sons and his daughters, and they came up to us. They said, look, we could never come out and say this, but we really appreciate you guys putting this film out. Nobody really knew that side of our dad, and you gave him a good time. And I don't want to get teary-eyed here, but the Cherokee's family the same way. There were so many people that we were just very humbled that we could at least in our humble way at least give them an avenue to be able to talk about their part of this film.
And that's what I wanted to, that's really what I wanted to kind of key on in being able to talk to you. I can tell you right now, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours with. I wanted to stick as much as I could to the people that most people regarding, they know Oklahoma City, but they don't know particulars. I want to talk about another person, Jane Graham.
Yes, sir.
Yep. Now, I told you from the very beginning, is I didn't smell a rat until they said that this thing was blown up by ANFO. And I'm like, nope, everybody in there knew the only way to make that happen, you need something with a high detonating velocity, a high, what we called relative effectiveness, something like C4, something with a high detonating velocity. So Jane Graham, not knowing what M112C4 looks like, sure described it. I mean, because what she was talking about with plastic putty, well, that's really not the way we typically do it. It's not like you see in the movies. It comes in a, if I remember right, the block is 11 inches long, 1 inch thick, and 2 inches wide.
Yes, sir.
And it is a lot like what she described. Now, with all these other people like Terrence Yakey and Hoppy and probably a number of others either being murdered or threatened, why don't you tell everybody about her and her role in this whole thing? Because it really flies right in the face of the official story.
She was a union head, a union steward for one of the unions that worked at the Murrah building. And I believe it was with HUD, if I'm not mistaken. And this will give you an idea of how scrappy and how no nonsense, she didn't take any garbage from anybody. But again, she wasn't, inappropriate. She didn't use swear words or anything. She went to high school with Jimmy Hoffa's daughter in Chicago. So this is, I mean, that's her pedigree of that's the crew that she hung out with. She ended up being a flight attendant with United Airlines and knew her way around. Very street smart, very professional, very tactful. But again, nobody's fool. Don't cross Jane Graham and try to lie to her because she'll call you out on it. Very much like Janie Coverdale, who we interviewed in the film too, the grandmother of two of the kids that got killed. Janie and Jane are of the same cloth. They'll call you out on your crap, you know, within a New York minute. Anyway, Jane, I'll never forget this. Early on when she was, there were a lot of people asking questions. Glenn Wilburn, who was the grandfather of two other kids that were killed in the bombing. Janie Coverdale, Jane Graham. And about a year after I met Jane, I was still living in Fort Worth, driving up to Oklahoma City before I relocated. And she said that it got to the point where she knew that her house was being broken into. Not to the, you know, it wasn't being torn apart, but things were moved around. And this was stuff that her housekeeper wouldn't move around because she knew the routine of her housekeeper. And she got to the point where she turned the tables on him and basically, you can imagine this, got a big rolling chalkboard with the wheels and put it in the foyer of her house and wrote down basically seven different things that she noticed was missing. And says, look, if you need my help, don't be breaking in the house. Just give me a phone call at work. I'll help you get what you need, but don't be jacking around my house. You know, she had valuables. She had precious metals and jewelry in the house. They didn't touch that, but they were looking for evidence and stuff, you know, that would support her questions. So she knew people were getting in her house. And I says, wow, that, you know, they take some, you know what, to call them out. And, you know, after that, they stopped. But that's how close there. Like I said, there was probably 20 people like that that were being tampered with either on their phones or their homes. And Jane Graham was a witness 3 days before it was a Thursday before that Sunday, which was Easter Sunday. And then the bombing happens the following Wednesday. She did notice in the parking ramp two levels down that there were Andre Strassmeyer, who we would a gentleman in his close likeness to Andre Strassmeyer, had gray sticks of butter, which was the Kinestec, I believe, or not Kinestec, but of the C4 and the phone wires. And they had a set of what she surmised was blueprints of the building. So, you know, then she put two and two together. There were people with GSA that she never saw. Then that's textbook CIA. You're hiring these people to come in. They have a front as a maintenance worker, and then you don't see them afterwards. They're gone. They may be on site for a week. That's typical, you know, special ops. So anyway, that's, you know, that was our exposure to Jane Graham. In fact, I talked to her about 6 months ago. We still keep in touch, but she was very helpful on at least us hashing out a narrative and putting together the info that we were getting from our sources at the Justice Department and the prosecutor's office, and just an amazing source to help us sort things out. We're always deeply indebted to her.
Okay, so we talked about some of the good guys in this story. Let's kind of swing on over to some of the bad guys. One of them you just mentioned a moment ago, Strassmeyer. Man, most people do not, they don't even know that name. They'd have no idea his involvement or role or any of that stuff in OKC. You want to give us a background on him?
Yes, sir. All right. So, again, going back 28, 29, almost 30 years, Al Gore and Bill Clinton in the White House. Al Gore was in charge of putting together a task force to infiltrate what was alleged to be neo-Nazi groups in the U.S. And for you folks that, you know, here we are almost three generations removed away from the case. For the younger generation especially, what the government defines as neo-Nazis are not actual neo-Nazis. Those are employees of the SPLC or the ADL or the FBI or the rejects, the washouts from the FBI, just to manufacture a threat to justify the budgets, the bloated budgets of a lot of these law enforcement agencies, including we found out that there were five agencies that were either involved and or investigating or trying to cover up this case that we never knew existed. And that was from a source at Tinker Air Force Base. That's a whole other movie for another time. Blew our mind. We had no idea that these agencies, again, it makes the CIA look like a kindergarten class. This is way deep. Deep ops, way beyond military. Anyway, Strassmeyer was the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, who was the chief of staff for, at the time, Helmut Kohl was the premier of the German government. Their equivalent to the president. And Gunter Strassmeyer's son, Andreas, was a washout from the German Special Forces, their counterpart to the Green Berets. So for some reason, Al Gore requests Andreas Strassmeyer to come to the U.S. to infiltrate these alleged neo-Nazi groups. Well, unbeknownst to Andreas Strassmeyer, the CIA, the FBI, and the ATF, and these other agencies had their operatives in with these neo-Nazi groups. So there was no communication. Eagle Wars, Turf Wars. The guys wanted their budgets. They weren't communicating with each other. That was basically the nexus, the foundation of what would eventually end up being the absolute horrific disaster of the Oklahoma City bombing. And again, here we are 28 years later, special prosecutor to Eric Holder. It's Merrick Garland, who would end up helping cover up the Oklahoma City case. He takes that whole concept of these neo-Nazi groups and extrapolates it to the J6 innocent defendants. And that's it's basically what happened in Oklahoma City on steroids.
Wow.
What Merrick Garland did, and I'm not going to go off on a tangent, but I'm going to tell you right now without any reservation, and I'm going to tell you flat out, bald-faced, what Merrick Garland did with the Oklahoma City case and covering it up, he should be in federal prison right now in Leavenworth, Kansas, because it was just horrendous how much money they spent in the effort and the years that they used to lie and obfuscate and create evidence to incriminate the defendants and withhold exculpatory information to show that not only Terry Nichols was innocent and McVeigh was set up. Nichols should have not been sent to prison for more than 2 or 3 years. And he's moldering in federal lockup at Supermax in Colorado right now for the rest of his life without a chance of parole. And that was at the behest of Merrick Garland, Eric Holder, all the way from the governor's office, Frank Keating, to the steps of the White House. We have a list of what they call the Dirty 30. And again, there's operatives within the Oklahoma City Police Department, the corrupt side, that helped foster this and obfuscate and support this criminal evidence. And it's horrible what they did. So if anybody that tells me, and Merrick Garland and all those guys are going to give you the official stock answer that was researched, I call BS on that. We've got the evidence, and I will sit down with him tomorrow if I had the opportunity and go through the reams of 142 boxes of information that Stephen Jones, Tim McVeigh's lead defense counsel, gave access, our film crew access to. Out of those 142, 120 will show that over 90% of that information was never presented to the grand juries in both federal trials, or excuse me, the juries in both federal trials. So it's just, don't get me worked up here, but Merrick Garland is corrupt and as criminal as the day is long.
Oh yeah, he's pure garbage, and there's a long list of others alongside of him. Speaking of Timothy McVeigh's lawyer, Stephen Jones, when I read that book, it was before I saw your film, and my wife had read it first, and I didn't understand the reasons why, but she had this immense fascination with what really happened there. So she read his book, and she kept telling me, "Look, you have got to read this book. You got to read this book," and that's why it was called, I was just, Others Unknown.
Yes, sir.
Let me check this out. My oldest brother was actually one of the physicians that was actually on site after the bombing, okay?
One of the triage sites? Yes, sir.
Yep, okay. He was there. And my other brother was on top of Baptist Hospital when this thing went off. Right. And he was working as a carpenter. And he swore, right off the bat, he was like, "Dude, I'm telling you, there were two blasts that went off there. I was on top of that hospital. I could hear it all the way over at Baptist Hospital." And he said, everybody there said they heard two blasts. I'm sure there was a number of other devices out there too. You know, we got a lot of nasty polecats going on with this whole thing. I got to know, Chris, I got a whole list of questions here I can go on and on about. Maybe we'll have to have you back on and maybe get to some of this. But I got to ask you, do you ever think we're ever going to see any justice for any of this? Because to my knowledge, I don't see it. And it doesn't – I remember seeing on the side of, I think it was the YMCA across from the bombing site, "We will never forget." Well, you couldn't even talk about this, the Oklahoma City bombing, in good company when I got out of the Army, without somebody saying, "Oh, it's over with," or "We don't need to know." Or when your film came out and I'm trying to tell every human being I can find, "Hey, you need to watch this." Everybody would just kind of acquiesce and not really take a second look at it. But do you think we're ever going to find this out?
Well, that's a good question. And the short answer is that we found out from an attorney, Ray Spence, or Jerry Spence, excuse me. He actually represented Randy Weaver in the debacle there with in Ruby Ridge, Idaho in 92. Anyway, Jerry Spence says that there is no statute of limitations on capital murder, but you have to be basically a party with legal standing to take legal action against the people that are responsible. There's very few people that have that legal standing that are willing to do that. Most of them have passed on. As a film crew, we couldn't do it, which really gave us the credibility. And that's why the FBI chose not to come after us. I'll never forget, this was a few days before we released the film. Our entertainment lawyer were in his office, and he said, look, guys, you know, the prosecution is going to come after you like a freight train, and the Justice Department, or you're going to hear crickets. There's not going to be anything in between. And we told him that our film, 95% of the information on that was based on the Justice Department's own documents, including what we got through, you know, Stephen Jones and the discovery. And Merrick Garland, for 3.5 months, pleaded with Judge Richard Mace to quash that evidence. What we saw, the juries in both federal trials and the Nichols and McVeigh trial, federal trials, never saw that information. There was no way that the FBI and the Justice Department was going to get us in court and have us call them on their bluff. We would have kicked them around like proverbially like a soccer ball, and we would have made complete fools of them. They were not going to set themselves up to fail. That's why we were never sued. But to answer your question, if somebody with legal standing chooses to go after them, they still can do that. And we found out through some the victim's family members that they can sue these guys civilly. They can put liens on their homes, on their motorcycles, on their RVs, on their condominiums, on their homes, and literally clean their clock. They still can do that. On a criminal side, the short answer is probably not. And, you know, I don't wish harm upon anybody. That's just not the way I was raised. I'm not wired like that. But, you know, if they met fate in an unforeseen way, I would not shed a tear, because knowing what these people did, including Merrick Garland and several other, you know, Larry Potts, number two of the FBI, who was McVeigh's handler. Yes, there was an official FBI handler for McVeigh in the 2.5 years leading up to the bombing. Anybody that has any issues with that, they're welcome to contact me in my email. I will walk you through that. Army CID officers, which is basically the military version, as you know, of the FBI, saw some of the footage we had on the film. We were able to get some of that footage, and we used slow motion graphics to make it look like video footage, but they were actually still photos from sources at Tinker Air Force Base. And they were retrieved by the search and rescue and search and recovery that were debriefed. These were, my God, coming in from Orange County, from Cook County, Chicago, Miami-Dade County, New York City, the county, their search and rescue. They were all there at the crime scene. And for the first 90 days, they were debriefed, I believe, on 2 12-hour shifts. So all of those photos, the slides and the negatives and the actual photos and all of that information was given to us by a source who has since passed on. He was in charge of the print and the photocopy lab at Tinker Air Force Base. And he says, we're giving you this information, him and his wife, help sort it all out. Please do not ever call me, but we want you guys to have this. And we know you can use this in the film. And it took us about 2 years to finally crack the seal on that massive Tupperware box. It probably weighed about 125 pounds. Remember, this is silver oxide, and the negatives and everything were pretty heavy at the time. This wasn't digital format. And what we saw as a film crew, that's evidence that we can use to form a case if we can get the right person with legal standing to go after these people. And Merrick Garland is on the short list, without a doubt. Yep.
Regarding, I've always wanted to ask somebody who might know the answer to this. You know, you had Bob, I can't remember, he was a district attorney in Oklahoma County at the time. I can't think of his name. He always had a bow tie, and there was never a camera that he didn't
Bob Macy. Bob Macy. Yes.
Bob Macy. Okay, yeah. So he brought around the trial, too. Why didn't he, I can't help but wonder if he must have been somehow in on it, because he never brought up any of the other evidence either, of the others unknown and all this other stuff. I mean, are you aware of his role in any of this?
I am. In fact, that's a great question. Very few people ask that. Wes Lane was his assistant at the time. But Bob Macy, in a closed-door meeting that Charles Key had, a lot of folks aren't aware. In fact, I'm going to show you the book here. The Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee was an independent of Charles Key, a former state representative with Oklahoma City, whose former secretary at the state capitol was killed in the Murrah building. She was working for the federal government at the time. Anyway, he's in a closed door meeting with his lawyer, who was a, I believe, a state senator at the time. and one of the few people that stuck up for Charles in doing this independent investigation. So they're in a closed door meeting with Bob Macy, Sandra Elliott, and some of the underlings of them that would eventually prosecute the state trial for Terry Nichols in 2003. And they asked, it was Charles Key and his lawyer that asked Bob Macy, he says, why aren't you telling us the truth about this? And Bob finally looked down and says, they told me to be quiet. And they asked him, who's they? And they surmised that, and this is an educated guess, that it was the federal authorities that basically told Bob to shut the F up and not to say a word. Now, I'm gonna take this one step further, Bill. Of all of this is the U.S. Congressional and the Senate representatives from Oklahoma. I believe there was two senators and six or eight representatives at the time. One that's still in office, Frank Lucas, and I'm gonna call out Frank Lucas on his BS right now. I saw him 2 years ago at the 27-year anniversary remembrance in Oklahoma City when I drove up there from where I live now out of state. Frank Lucas is sitting up there, and I thought, you lying SOB, you knew damn well what happened. You have the mitigated gall to sit there and the temerity to say everything's been answered about this. And I did all I could from just standing up in this, there are 300 people at the Methodist Church across from the bombing site, and to really call him out on his BS. But I says, no, this is not my time to call attention to this. We're trying to respect the, anyway, Frank Lucas was among that congressional group that were basically told by the FBI, and we found out through some back channels at Tinker Air Force Base, again, that other side group of the CIA to shut the F up and not ask any questions. There was only one guy, and Charles Key had a chance to talk to him, and much to his credit, Steve Largent. He was a rep at the time. Steve Largent, former wide receiver with the Seattle Seahawks from Tulsa, right. Oklahoma. He was a rep at the time. And Steve pulled Charles aside. This was in a meeting in Oklahoma City, relevant to Oklahoma City, the bombing. And Largent says, yeah, we were basically given the marching orders within about 10 hours of the bombing to shut up, not to touch this thing with a 100-foot pole, and to not walk away, but run away from it as fast as we can. That was it. And we do have a photo of all things. And I don't think we tried to work this into the script of the film. But there's a photo of these guys sitting in a boardroom at Tinker Air Force Base being debriefed on all of the very sensitive photos and the evidence and the casualties, the bomb damage, everything. They were given the whole rundown of what happened. And that's what they were told to shut up about, not to repeat what they saw in that boardroom in a closed door briefing. And it was at Tinker Air Force Base. And lo and behold, you had J.C. Watts. You had Nichols is in there. Who's the senator that just resigned from... they retired from the Senate. Long time. Nichols.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. He just resigned, I believe, last year. Those guys are getting a big fat pension for all their service. But all of those guys are in this photo, and I thought, son of a buck. Largent wasn't there. At least he wasn't in the frame, but he said, yeah, he sat in on that meeting too. And he went home and he told his wife, and he literally cried till. He said he was in tears till about 3 a.m. He says, how the hell can we shut up about this? So I'm going to tell your listeners and whoever the viewers of this, you have been lied to about this. There's more evidence out there. We know that 12 to 18 people were involved. McVeigh was working for the CIA at the time for at least 2.5 years leading up to the bombing. Evidence, reams of documentation and evidence was made up out of whole cloth to frame Terry Nichols. And it was at the behest of Eric Holder and Merrick Garland, and it went to the steps of the White House. Without a doubt, our film crew has this evidence, and if we have the opportunity to present this in front of a grand jury again, I will drop whatever I'm doing. You give me a week's notice, and I will be there, because the people of Oklahoma City, the victims' family members and survivors, and my God, the souls of these people that died need to at least be remembered in the truth versus a lie, without a doubt. And in a very humble way, our film was a two-hour effort to try to at least open the door to that.
Well, there's a lot of folks in Oklahoma right now that might just take you up on that. I mean, they're listening. They're going to be listening to this podcast. And it's, you know, there needs to be some light put on this. Yes. Chris, before we close, I gotta ask one. This might sound totally off the wall, but I know you covered it a little bit with TD. By the way, I'm going to give a shout out to TD over at the Fearless podcast. I'm going to ask about Man, this is, some folks are going to think I've gone completely off the rails with this, but I gotta know.
Okay.
Whatever happened of, I agree with you, Nichols. Even when the trial was going on, I was like, none of this seems to really, I don't get this. None of this is really making sense. It sounded like it was all made up. McVay seems like he was sheep dipped, probably yes. Washed out of SF. He looks classic, sheep dipping. Is this dude really dead, or is he sitting somewhere on a beach? No. Because I've heard too many people talk about this guy wasn't actually, he never stopped breathing after they shot him up. What's your opinion?
Honestly, and that's a question that's been posted to us many times, and I'll never forget this. When Craig Roberts and I were on an interview together with a host out of Sweden, we didn't even skip a beat, and we both said it pretty much simultaneously. No, I don't think he's dead. Why? Because there was a source among many of the federal government that helped us out. Some are retired, some active, including Secret Service and retired member of the CIA that worked on white collar crime and saw the financial side of the Oklahoma City bombing. And he told me, he says, look, you'd have a hell of a time recruiting for the CIA if you're going to kill off your assets. He says he didn't think McVay was killed. There's a way that they handle situations like that. There is the what they call witness protection. And that's basically done in coordination with the Canadian government, too, and far northern Canada. I know this, the town where they bring these people in. Within 2 weeks, your identity, everything is completely wiped off of anything remotely connected to the internet. You're starting out as though you were 5 years old with a credit rating, no credit, nothing. They give you a new life. The CIA takes that and brings it basically to the power of three or four. This is way, way off the scale of witness protection, and you will never know where McVay is. And honestly, I will say without a doubt, I don't think McVay's dead. There's no way in hell they would kill him, because what he did for the CIA leading up to the Oklahoma City bombing, that line of recruiting for the CIA will dry up real quick if they know you're going to start killing off your assets. It's completely counterintuitive to how they do things. So
yeah,
he's dead.
He's probably sharing a room with Epstein somewhere, and with a new face and the whole nine yards, yeah, and all the other pole cats that they've let get away with bloody murder on this stuff, quite literally.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get down to brass tacks, I mean, this whole thing, even from the very beginning of it, it was like, okay, let me get this right. And I was, like I said, I was still a soldier at the time, and I'm thinking, hang on, let me just work with me here. You mean to tell me they just pull McVay over, who just happened to not have a license plate on the doggone car? Officer just happens to see this hog leg sitting on his side with black talon bullets in it, and they put him out there up, here I am, and just assume, just on the basis of that, it reminds me an awful lot like what they did to Lee Harvey Oswald. Of all the people in the world, they just pick this guy out, parade him out there for everybody to see, people calling him a murderer right there on the steps. It was almost like I was watching a script. And I don't believe for a minute that this guy's dead anywhere. I'm like I said, he's probably off somewhere with Epstein. Who even knows?
Can I share something with you on one of our last interviews that we were going to do? A gal by the name of Jermaine Johnston. So we're talking about 18 minutes after the bombing. It was called Southwestern Bell at the time. Now it's called the AT&T building in downtown Oklahoma City. When I close my eyes, Billy, the crime scene, I can see it's literally 4.5 square miles around downtown Oklahoma City, not the 3 or 4 blocks that CNN and a lot of the affiliates had in their little media city. What we learned in the 8.5 years leading up to the release of our film is that the operatives that pulled this off, the 12 to 18, were living and at a motel 4.5 miles away. We knew their round, their route that they took that at 6 to 6:30 that morning. They called it the Caravan of Death. The vehicles that were heading toward downtown Oklahoma City that were used as a ruse, as a decoy. That truck bomb was actually an afterthought. It was blown up 5 to 8 seconds after the Murrah building was coming down. Now, I'm also going to call out the bluff with all due respect to the volunteers and the docents at the Oklahoma City National Memorial. People need to be hold to task and proverbially her feet to the fire. The director of the Oklahoma City National Memorial, Kerry Watkins, to this day is still pandering a story that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The narrative they have in that museum has four different routes and four different narratives coming together, and they all contradict what the official narrative is. So it's a complete train wreck of information in that museum. I tried to sit down with her and the Board of Trustees early on when I first moved to Oklahoma City. They wouldn't have anything of it. I was persona non grata in the 18 times that I visited that museum just to go back and see if they had any made any responsible or mature or intelligent effort to straighten out the story. They chose not to. And to this day, they will swear that they have all the information straight. My point is that those folks, either inadvertently or with malice and with forethought and conscientiously, as mature adults, are continuing to lie to the public. They're committing fraud, and they need to be called out on their bluff. So if anybody has any questions on that, I will point them in the right direction on what to look for in that museum. And to this day, still proves that the official narrative is complete garbage. And then some of the forensic evidence they have in that museum proves that, the narrative is complete garbage.
Wow. It's like, you know, I think, Chris, it would almost be easier to cite. I mean, if you were to make a list, on one side, you had all the things that are plausible in the official story and all the things that are impossible in that official story. I mean, good night. I can't think of one thing that has been that's been proclaimed officially that has actually panned out to be true. I mean, it would be easier to line up the other side of the things. I mean, I'll tell you, the thing that floors me at the end of this is I go back to what I said a moment ago. Like, my other brother, Terry, by the way, was at the YMCA right across the street from there when that thing went off. And he got glass all in his feet when that thing went down. And he said the same exact thing that, you know, it wasn't like they said, but he was unable for some reason. He was always a troubled soul anyway, but he could never really explain, but he was like, it's not what they say it is. He was literally at that YMCA when this thing went off. Mm-hmm. And he was sleeping in one of the rooms there. Like I said, he got glass in his feet and the whole nine yards. And everything that I've been told by people that were down there at the site, you know, things that just make no sense, where they call off everybody so they can go gather up a bunch of papers. I mean, this thing, yes, I mean, before we, I know we got to come to a close here, Chris, and I hope you don't mind asking one last question.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I got to know so they were out there doing the, you know, recovery, and then all of a sudden everybody gets called away. What was that all about?
Sir. Okay. So that morning we had clear skies. We were looking at the National Weather Service archives, 42 mile an hour wind coming into the building. And, the explosion happens, but there were 23 devices in the building. Three of them had gone off. So the double explosion that most people heard was the first and second device, and they were within a few seconds of each other. Then you had the blast wave attenuation. This thing was so powerful, and ANFO wouldn't do this, that there were strip malls and storefronts in Midwest City, a good, 8 miles from downtown Oklahoma City. Their window, their pane, the plate glass windows from literally floor to ceiling were being pushed in by that blast wave attenuation. It was ferocious. General Parton told us basically the devices in that building caused an invisible mushroom cloud to raise up in the air almost 400 feet. We're talking 40 stories. What that did is it literally sucked. And the mushroom cloud creates an instantaneous vacuum. You have to have replacement of the air to fill that void. What it did is it sucked all the papers, anything that was lightweight, trash from the streets, small tree limbs, leaves, everything were literally sucked up in this visual mushroom cloud and spread over 8 blocks and almost in a symmetrical pattern, aside from that 42 mile an hour wind coming from the north. So most of that debris, paperwork and everything, was pushed to the south, about 2 to 3 blocks from the Murrah building, and a little bit rested on the crime scene. Tornado comes through. The fact it was so, the weather was so horrendous that afternoon that they had to shut the airport down. It takes a lot for the FAA to shut an airport down and ground all flights. Tornado came through, a lot of rain, which corrupted the crime scene. So that crater, the alleged crater from the bomb that allegedly tore the building apart, was full of water. There was about 3 feet of water in that. And it just like the forensic evidence was completely trashed. And the FBI tried to say that was credible. That's another story for another time. But to get to your point is, Don Browning, who was one of the canine rescue officers who was in our film, said that there were people that were dying and the debris reaching through, screaming. You know, it had fatal and mortal wounds, bleeding out. And they were screaming for search and rescue to come in. and the FBI, and again, not the CIA, but there were other agencies we didn't even know existed, were coming in and basically telling the fire department and the police department and first responders to get the hell out on the north side of the building where the gaping hole was. They were evacuated to the plaza on the south side, which is still there. And they were told to stand down for close to 2.5 hours. So these people were bleeding out. They're buried in the rubble. And these agents, both male and female agents, were coming in and trying to recover. Paperwork and documents were sensitive. We found out that the CIA did have some documents in there. We don't know what they pertain to. But, you know, a random miscellaneous video footage from the county sheriffs corroborated that. And they were coming in and trying to abscond and get all of these records. Could care less about the people that were, and some of them did die because of that, for that 2.5 hours. I mean, they can only survive so long from their, you know, their mortal wounds. So Don Browning was absolutely apoplectic. He says he was furious that he could not go and do his job. And what he, you know, he was wearing his badge and he swore an oath to try to help these people. And he was basically told to shut the F up, sit down with his dog in the rain and the rain slickers while they were freezing their tail off. And just to stand still while these other people basically took the documents out in gurneys, and they were put in SUVs and driven away from the crime scene. And after that, they were basically, it was a search and recovery at that point. There were very few people that survived that. So
completely dreadful. I mean, sadly, as we come to a close here, we didn't even cover your other films, Good Night, and they're worth checking out, y'all. Shadow Ring and State of Mind. Chris, I got, man, you're going to have to come back sometime because I got a whole list of questions here, and I would love to. Of them covered, because I know a lot of people are going to be reaching out, and they're going to be like, "Hey, I'd like to know this. I'd like to know that." But folks, you got to check out his work, Chris. I got to ask you before we kind of lead everybody to where they can go find your work. Do you have any projects coming up that they want to?
I've got some scripts here. Again, I've been reading over some scripts on my desk. There are two projects coming out. I do have what they call a non-disclosure agreement. I can't reveal the subject right now, but I've been asked to fly out of state to work on one that just happened recently. Once we're able to disclose the information on that, reason being is that we don't want the nefarious individuals to get in the way of what we're doing right now. There is one historical film that is going to deal with history all the way back to the First World War, and there's something on a current case, and then there are two or three others in the back burner. If people do want to watch our films, please do so at our website. They're easy accessible. They're free, and we do get paid on the ad revenue. Please do not go onto YouTube and watch the pirated comedies. We do not get paid that way. So Free Mind Films with an S, freemindfilms.com. If you do want to contact me, I am not on social media because we've been completely pillaged on social media, and we just don't want to deal with that malarkey anymore. They can contact me at my email address, which is ccemery, C-C-E-M as in Michael, E-R-Y, at protonmail.com. And as TD will attest and many others, if you email me, I'm very good about getting back to you within at least 24 hours. I will respond right away if you have any questions, and I would love to, at least if I don't know the answer, I'll be the first to admit I don't know all the answers, but I will steer you in the right direction to at least let you know where you can find the answers.
Well, Chris, I sure hope you get with me whenever you got another project going out. I mean, and we'll have to have you on regarding more of Oklahoma City. And like I said, you got two other films that we didn't even touch yet, and everybody ought to watch them. So go check out the links. We'll leave everything down below, folks. Remember, stay alert, stay alive. They don't want the individual, just a carbon copy. You sitting at Manicotti, yeah, I'm talking saucy. All they want to build is a prison world full of pet Tamagotchis. The kamikaze got me out of body like I'm Goku SS3. They want to push me to the center like a cell. They want to spin up at the center of the nexus. Me. They want me to bow down, but I'm a warrior.